Blog Talk Radio.
Quiet, please. Welcome to Rex Sykes' Movie Beat, conversations with filmmakers where we discuss everything film and television. Here on Movie Beat, you'll learn what to do and what not to do when it comes to making movies and TV. We will talk to everyone behind the scenes and in front of the camera, and I will provide you with guests and the information you're going to want to have, whether you're a filmmaker or a fan. And so now let's move behind the scenes here at Movie Beat. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in today. Thanks for your support. Thanks for reading the blogs and staying in touch with us here at Movie Beat. My guest today is Mr. John Cowley. He's working on a major motion picture right now. I'm going to let him tell you a little bit about that. He's in the visual effects industry. He's worked as a visual effects supervisor, and he's going to be coming up in just a short bit. First, I got a couple of announcements. The first being, of course, that you're listening to Rex Sykes Movie Beat at REXSIKES.com. That's my name. REXSIKES.com is the official website. You can subscribe using the RSS button right there at the welcome page, and you'll always be updated to changes occurring on the website, additions that new interviews and new listings and new events and things like that. Movie Beat is really designed to be a resource for you, and that is why I connect you with professionals who are making it happen. And in exchange, what I'd like you to do is go ahead and retweet about my guests, about the show, share it far and wide, use Facebook, MySpace, use your favorite means to share this with your friends and your industry connections, because by spreading the word, more filmmakers, more television makers, more content providers are going to learn about Movie Beat and these incredible interviews with guests who share their expertise, who share their know-how, who share their experiences with you so that you can work smarter and faster and quicker and get your projects done. So please go ahead and continue to share. Join the Facebook Rex Sykes Movie Beat fan page. Join the Rex Sykes Movie Beat group. But help us spread the word and get the word out. And I sure appreciate your support by emails, letters, phone calls, and when I meet you in person. If you're listening to this live, go ahead and make us a friend or a fan right where you're at. The chat room is open. You can join us there. If you've got questions, we'll try and ask them of my guests. That's my promise to you. And if you're listening to this archived, you're at rexsykes.com at the interviews blog. You go in there, you check out the names of the guests that you want to listen to. Pay no attention to the date that is on the blog. Pay no attention. That's my manufactured date. Don't worry about it at all. Just go find the name of the guest that you want to hear. Click on that link. It'll open up a biography page so that you can read about the guest. And inside that biography page is a link, a bold link that says, to listen here, click. And you can click. If you're listening live from the website, you've done that already. If you're listening, if you're going to the archives, that's how you do it. And keep in mind, there are over 100-some-odd interviews there of other fabulous guests you're going to want to listen to. Now, good news is you can also get all of these interviews as podcasts from the iTunes Store absolutely free. You can download them, and then every time there's a new interview, it will add into your iTunes subscription of Rex Sykes Movie Beat. Now, that is an incredible value. Free for you, and all I'm asking you to do is go ahead and continue to spread the word. I have a couple of announcements that I want to make. Continue to be aware that at the Hot and Fun blog on RexSykes.com is the V-Pipe screenplay pitch contest that goes until the 15th of April. And so you're going to want to make sure that you take advantage of that. If you've got a project that you want to pitch, go check that out and check out their official website. But all the information will be there. Kevin Sorbo's a World Fit for Kids charity golf tournament is coming up in June. Please check into that. And Mike Matzdorf, a recent guest, is the director of a movie called Feed the Fish. He's going to be in Madison, Wisconsin for the Wisconsin Film Festival, which runs April 14th to the 18th. But Feed the Fish, starring Tony Shalhoub and others, is going to screen Friday, April 16th, the 10 to 15 p.m. show. I'm going to go there. Let me know if you're going to go and meet us up there, and we'll all have a good time checking out Feed the Fish. There are other Wisconsin movies. Mary Sweeney, who's been David Lynch's editor, has a new movie called Baraboo that will be screening, I believe, the next day around 7 o'clock on the 17th. I plan to attend that as well. There are other films that you should check out. But if you're in Wisconsin, be sure to attend the Wisconsin Film Festival. My Twitter address is Rex Sykes Movie BT, REXSIKESMOVIEBT. So follow us on Twitter, please, and help us spread the word. All right, I want to bring on my guest now, and I'm really excited about this. We're going to talk some really fascinating stuff. His name is John Cowley, and he's been entrenched in the visual effects industry for the past 12 years, both as an artist and on-set supervisor, and within various visual effects facilities. Now, over the time, he's had the pleasure of visual effects supervising feature film work throughout Canada, into the United States, and on select projects for Chinese market. Now, recent projects include the Academy Award-nominated District 9, both for Best Picture and Best Visual Effects, and the upcoming Twilight Saga Eclipse. Past credits both as an artist and a supervisor include Smallville, Watchmen, X-Files, I Want to Believe, Panic Room, and Stay. So John is a board member of the Vancouver branch of Visual Effects Society and stays active within the visual effects community. I'm bringing him on here right now so we can say hello. John, how are you?
I'm very good, thanks.
Awesome.
Deep in final delivery and wide awake at an early part of the day here on the West Coast.
Well, very good. Now, you are a busy man. I mean, and I appreciate you being able to squeeze this in. Could you tell our listeners what's going to be happening in about the next hour?
In the next hour, on this interview, we'll be talking about District 9 and just answering any questions people have about how that film was made and my role and Image Engine, the company that I'm working for here in Vancouver, their role. I can talk a little bit about Twilight, but only in sort of holistic terms because we're in the middle of that production still, and there's all sorts of non-disclosure agreements and sort of tight-lipped things that we can't talk about at this particular stage, but I can't talk about it in general terms. And I'm happy to talk about just the state of the industry. Just like the movie industry is having some challenges in California as a whole, the visual effects industry being relatively new is changing dramatically over the past couple of years and in the coming years. And there's lots of turmoil and decisions we made about how that's going to look in the face of the visual effects industry in North America.
Absolutely. Now, after our hour, and all that is fascinating, I can't wait to get into that discussion, you run right from the interview to what?
back to Twilight. At this particular stage, we're about 2 weeks out from the final delivery on the overwhelming majority of the film. So we're delivering about 280 visual effects shots for that. We started back in September, so it's been a long, long haul, everything from the on-set supervision side of things to working on the initial shots and developing some of the effects and the looks, and then now we're just in that brute force stage where we're just sort of rippling all of that R&D and development through a whole host of shots and hopefully delivering this thing on time. So we're probably 6-7 day weeks right now, 12-hour days, and I think we've got about 80 artists working on the show at this particular stage.
And can we discuss your role in this?
Yeah, so on this particular show, most of the sort of visual effects supervisors in this industry are freelance. So we move from project to project, and our titles usually change and our roles change on each facility. So, for example, on Twilight, I am the visual effects supervisor for Image Engine. What that means is that usually the production, especially on a large show with a lot of visual effects, will have a production side visual effects supervisor hired by the studio or the director on that side of things. And then the individual facilities that are awarded work will have their in-house visual effects supervisor, and that's my role on this particular film.
Can I ask if this is, union post crew or non-union post crew? Or
visual effects isn't unionized. There are some pushes in Vancouver to start to unionize some of the on-set component, which is really just a small fraction of the visual effects industry. So, for example, on Twilight, we may have had one or two people on set, but there are 80 people back here in the facility. So there is a bit of a drive in Vancouver to start to change that. There's a lot of resistance. There's some excitement for that one, and I'm not quite sure where that's going to go. My understanding of the California facilities is I think some of the larger facilities are unionized, but the overwhelming majority of the visual effects artists in the industry are not.
Can you tell us kind of by list or by rote, who comprises or what titles, occupations comprise, this area of visual effects, the different kinds of people who work under a supervisor, the different departments that are required in making a movie like Twilight or District 9?
Yes, it's actually massive, and there are quite a few different departments there. Most of these titles people may not have heard of unless they've pulled up some behind-the-scenes article online. Essentially, the way a show is structured is that on the facility side of things, there is a visual effects supervisor and a visual effects producer. Obviously, the producer is dealing with the money and the schedule, and the supervisor is dealing with all of the creative content, making sure that we're telling the director's story in a visual way that he wants or she wants. Below that, we usually have a team of supervisors that are in charge of the various departments. So, for example, on the shows that I've worked on, we have an animation department. The animation department is creating all of the character work, the movement, the expressions. For example, in District 9, we had a huge team that was working on just creating all the performances of the aliens that were in that film. Mm-hmm. There's another department, which is called Assets, and in really many, many respects, the digital side of things sort of mirrors the on-set side of things. You can almost see some parallel roles, except we're just dealing with pixels instead. So we have an asset department, and the asset department is building our digital props and our digital characters. Everything that you see in a film that had to be digitally created had to be built by somebody. It had to be textured and painted, all the sort of same way that things would happen practically on set. We have another department, which is lighting, and what lighting does is they take those assets, they take those creatures, whatever it will be, and they will match the lighting that was created on set. We have our on-set supervisors take reference of the lighting environments. Sometimes if you're on set, you'll see people walking around with these big silver balls or big gray balls that they hold up in the air. We use those to kind of get a sense of where the key light is, where the bounce light is, the intensity of the lights. So we use that information in the lighting department to try to make sure that our digital assets look like they sit perfectly into the live-action plates that were shot. We have another department, which is called compositing, and if anyone has ever used Photoshop, you know how you can kind of put layers together and you can tweak those individual layers. Compositing is the team that takes the live-action elements, the computer-generated elements, and mashes them all together and makes them look like they all belong in the same environment. There's a whole preps department as well, so we have a BG prep, background prep department. And what they do is they take the grip who happened to be standing on the right side of frame and shouldn't have been in the camera, or anything that needs to be painted out that shouldn't be there. That's their job to remove and prep the background plates to clean those up. For example, on District 9, we actually had a live-action actor in a gray suit who was performing with the Vickers character in that particular film, and the BG Prep's job was to paint that person out. And then the other department we have is a department called MatchMove, and MatchMove is responsible for recreating digitally the camera that existed in all of those scenes. So if there's a moving camera shot, we need to digitally match move that camera in three-dimensional space so that when our character moves through it, he is walking through a matched-up environment. Lots of people.
Indeed. Now, once all of the visual effects are created, now, there's somebody on set. I mean, there's visual effects on set. What do they do on set?
They're kind of quality control. The job for... we can do almost anything nowadays, but budget is obviously a limitation.
Sure.
So you can just go and shoot, and we'll just fix it all in post, as that sort of famous saying goes. But ideally, there are certain things that you should or shouldn't do when you're on set filming. There are things that may seem simple and that shouldn't be a big deal that can cost tens of thousands of dollars. At the same time, there's other things that may seem quite complicated, but if they're just done right or in a particular way, or the bit of due diligence they can actually be fairly inexpensive. So the job of a visual effects supervisor, on-set supervisor, is really there to be as a consultant to make sure that things are shot a particular way so that we can do our job in post-production afterwards. And a lot of it is just gathering reference to try to get as much information, camera distances, camera height, the location of the practical lights on set. All that information just helps the artists at the end of the pipe do their job better.
Awesome. Can you describe some of those things that you shouldn't do on set, or some of those things that if you do right, you know, can be a boon later on? I mean, you mentioned it just a moment ago.
Well, there are simple examples. Again, it's all budget dependent. So if you're shooting an independent film and you're trying to do things on a lower budget, there's certain things you may or may not want to do, or you may not realize that we can pick that up in the post side of the world and recreate what you wanted to do without sort of compromising the quality. So, for example, one of the simplest things is if a camera is moving in three-dimensional space on set, then you're getting parallax. Everything is shifting in the background, is moving in the background. So sometimes some effects can be very hard to match into that environment because everything is moving in perspective. But if you lock off the camera and just have a nodal camera move, where the camera's just swinging back and forth, touching up and down, whatever, then there isn't any parallax in that scene. Everything is really, from our set of things, just a still that happens to be sliding back and forth. And we can put things into that environment much more easily than if the camera is, you know, even sliding a few inches to the left, a few inches to the right. Introducing parallax introduces a whole other world of hurt for us.
So if they're on a steady cam or they're doing a dolly shot or anything like that, that makes it tough.
Again, it can all be done. And the nice thing with our industry is that it is still changing. The technology is still evolving. And as every year goes by, there are less and less visual effects no-nos on set that are going to get you in trouble. If we went back 10 years ago, a Steadicam shot would have been an absolute nightmare. We would have figured it out, but it would have been an absolute nightmare to try to get that to work. But the software and the technicians and the IT people behind the scenes are continually evolving and finding new ways of mathematically getting us out of those problems. So a Steadicam shot is easier to do now than it was in the past, but there still are potential complications.
Well, that's absolutely, you know, good news. I mean, it's fascinating and it's exciting to know that corrections can be made in post. However, if you are on a limited budget, I bet some of those post corrections can change your budget.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Visual effects budget, you know, speaking with producers, it's the usually it's one of the few line items on a on your end budget that doesn't go down and doesn't stay the same. It usually goes up. So we will quote in advance for what people intend to shoot or what they think they're going to shoot, and try to build a budget for that, but guarantee the number amount that you start with and the number amount that you end up with will not be the same.
Wow. Well, and it makes perfect sense. So let me take from here then, and whenever you can and you come back with some more examples of what they should or shouldn't do will be great. But I want to talk about the role of a visual effects supervisor and why they should be part of your core team and not just an afterthought, you know, from budgeting on. Let's go into that.
It's the whole industry is becoming very digital now. Visual effects used to be a call that was made after the edit was half assembled and people started to figure out what they actually wanted to do, what they wanted to fix. As the viewers, educational eye is sort of changing, their expectations are changing. If you go back 10 years ago to what was then a top-notch visual effects film, and you look at that and you scrutinize that, that just won't hold up anymore. I watched, I think it was the second Aliens film the other day, and it was great at the time, but if you look at the visual effects now, it needed a lot of work to really kind of match the bar that's today. So with the expectations changing, having someone like myself on set and consulted early on can, one, just help you get out of any potential corners or pitfalls down the road. It can help keep your budget in line. And, really, it's we're not post-production anymore, and that's probably one of the biggest changes in the visual effects industry. We are pre-production, we're production, and post-production on the overwhelming majority of films nowadays. If you're just doing a few little effects, yeah, call us at the end and we'll make it work. But if you're going to have anything more than 10 or 15 visual effects, it's certainly worth your time, energy, and that phone call to make sure you actually get what you were hoping for.
Now, you do all the visual stuff, and then that, with the rest of the footage, gets handed over to post-production sound?
Yeah, so what we're usually working on some shots while the production is still filming. We'll get a few plates scanned early on. You should test a couple of our approaches to make sure they're going to work, because they're all theories before that stage. As the edit is coming together, and there is no such thing as a final edit anymore. There's usually a final edit on the last day before the digital intermediate. We're continuing to drop new shots and new plates in and work through that. We don't deal with sound too much unless something is sound sensitive. So, for example, if an actor is talking, or we're trying to have a digital character who's talking, we'll need that sound sync. But for the most part, we're just dealing with images at this particular stage. We usually have a copy of the edit in-house that we're dropping our footage in to make sure it works well with the editor's edit, and that's sort of the extent of our post-production involvement.
So from early on, I imagine as a supervisor, you get the screenplay and you begin talking with the director about how to make their vision come about, and then in pre-production you start planning how it's done?
Yes. Yeah, the beginning is all the idea stage. I'm trying to remember what the quote is, and it's not coming to me right now, but there's someone talked about, one of the most expensive lines in a script, and it was something to the extent all hell broke loose. And
right.
That one line is millions of dollars, depending on the director's vision of that particular scene. So we'll get the script usually. We'll go through, try and flag what we think is a potential visual effect or something we know. One of the things that I quite often I'm asked what some of my favorite films are, I'd like to talk about Lawrence of Arabia. And Lawrence of Arabia, for me, especially being in this industry, it's a kind of film that would never be made the way it was made anymore. You'll never have 10,000 warriors on horses running down through the desert anymore. Now that's going to be, there's a program called Massive that can create all of these digital characters. They can all fight and interact with each other, and you'll only have a couple of actors close up to the front of camera that are live, and everything else is sort of CG. Those are the kind of things we look for when we're looking at a script now, is to see what is a visual effect, what would be better off to shoot over green screen or blue screen. There's a couple of big things, water, smoke, fire, to help do that safely as well. And then we'll get involved in the storyboard stage of things, hopefully. Sometimes we will bring some of our own artists on board to create concept art to try and give some look to what that visual effect might be. And then we'll start to build a shooting plan. So if we know of a particular shot, if there's going to be actors on wires or harnesses or having to be running through some environment that they can't practically shoot, quite often we'll do what's really big in our industry right now is previs. So previs is very low resolution, very simple, all computer generated environments where we'll put in almost game quality characters. We'll build the camera moves in that environment in advance. Some directors are famous for that. Like Zack Snyder almost uses his previs to the letter, I'm told, that a whole team will run around, build all the shots in advance. They'll cut them together in a visual effects edit, for lack of better terms, before shooting even starts, and just figure out their more complicated, more expensive, more technically challenging sequences well in advance. And then we go about making the movie.
It's an incredibly complex business, and that's why there's a supervisor.
Exactly. It makes it, and then especially once you get into the end side of things, you're dealing with scans. You're also dealing with politics. What's nice is a visual effects supervisor on the production side of things is accountable to the studio, whereas a visual effects producer or supervisor on my end is accountable to the facility. So quite often you'll have that production side visual effects supervisor who's dealing with all of the nitty-gritty, dealing with scans and scan houses, working hand-in-hand with the post-production supervisor and the production side visual effects supervisor to manage all the different facilities that are involved as well. So, for example, on Twilight, I think there's a good handful of facilities that are involved, and that person has to kind of run point between all of those companies, be the eye that sort of vets what gets shown to the director and what doesn't, and just manages that side of the process as well.
It's all absolutely fascinating. A possible quote that you were thinking of is something that Peter Marshall often says, and that is, you know, the army went over the hill.
Okay,
and
that's the one. Exactly.
Something like that, you know. And then right after that, you said Lawrence of Arabia. So I mean, it was like,
yeah, exactly,
perfect.
Exactly.
No, your brain.
And it's a shame that film will never be made that way again. And you know, I think people will be wowed by what we can do. But there is, and that's, you know, part of a conversation as well. There's visual effects, and there's taking visual effects too far. There's trying to show too much. And those give us some interesting sort of aesthetic choices. Just as any new technology, even on-set technology, comes along, there's a phase where people go too far with it, experiment with it, play with it, and eventually find what works and what doesn't. I think the same thing's sort of happening with stereoscopic film right now and some of the 3D films that are coming out right now. They're kind of in this experimental phase, although I guess it's the third kick of the can for 3D movies over the years. But everything has its sort of growth and maturity phase, and I think visual effects is starting to hit that same sort of groove right now.
Again, amazing. And yes, I want to have that conversation with you because there is a lot, just an absolute lot, to continue to discuss. You had mentioned, you know, that, for example, now you can use a program and shoot with a couple actors in the foreground, and do you manipulate the background? In other words, if you've created multiple horsemen or horse people, to be politically correct, I guess, during a battle scene, do you manipulate them in where they are and where they're positioned so it doesn't look like the same crowd coming down the hill at the same
Absolutely.
Time?
Absolutely. Because all that is footage, and if it's shot, even if it's shot incorrectly, we can still make that happen. If it's shot correctly, hopefully a lot of that is shot over a green screen or a blue screen, which means that we can isolate their performance, we can move them around relative to the camera, we can repeat them, we can offset them, we can duplicate them, we can flip, we can flop, and you know, just populate all the back of a scene and just reuse those performances again and again. Even if they're not shot over a blue screen or a green screen, we have another department called rotoscoping, and those guys and gals will go through and basically kind of cut out them off of a background performance and do the exact same sort of thing. It really depends on what the camera is doing. If the other kind of software that exists is like that one called Massive, and that will take performances that are created and duplicate them and repeat them and flip and flop them as well. There really is no limit other than time and budget to what we're capable of doing.
Can I ask then if this, with Massive and with this kind of creation, is it important to have the camera locked down like we were talking before, or can the camera be moving?
The camera, for the most part, and there's very few directors that are going to want to have their cameras limited, and that's, I think, why the industry is trying to evolve the technology, is so that we're an asset on set and not a limitation on set. And thankfully, the business is kind of getting that sort of stage where, especially for the larger films, you know, they can do whatever they want and we'll make it work. If you are dealing with smaller budgets, yes, and sometimes there are certain things that we can do, but locking down the camera would probably help in this particular scenario or that particular scenario. And again, that's where that early consultation phase will help isolate what some of those particular shots would be.
Awesome. Let me, John, I got to take a quick break here, and then we'll come right back and pick this up. You're listening to Rex Sikes Movie Beat. The official website is REXSIKES.com, and we always appreciate your comments and your support about blogs and articles and conversations. Please do feel free to email me through the website if you hear about something coming up before I do, and I'll try and vet it, investigate it, and get it up in a timely fashion. Let me say that my next interview is with producer-director Sarah Neen Bruce. She's coming up next, and Eduardo Ballerini, the actor, he's been here before. Nick Mancuso will return, Larry Thomas, the soup Nazi from The Seinfeld Show, and many more. Bob Hercules, documentary film producer, and Juliet Landau is an actor who you best know probably from Drusilla as Drusilla on Buffy and on Angel, as well as she starred in the Ed Wood movie, and just so many more. So please do stay tuned to Rex Sykes Movie Beat. And if you're listening to this as a podcast, please go ahead and rate and review the show. I'm discussing visual effects and visual effects supervision with John Towley, and a pleasure it is. John, let me ask you this. The difference between blue and green screen today, is there much of a difference, and why do they use one versus the other?
Again, the technology has evolved that there really isn't too much of a difference, but there are sort of select scenarios where it's better to use blue or green. Getting technical, when you shoot on film and that image gets scanned, we get a red, green, blue RGB image that comes back to us. And that sort of world, the blue channel of most images is more noisy. The grain in a film and the film stock that you use, if you're using a grainier film stock, that grain will show up more in the blue, which can sometimes give this little bit of a boiling visual kind of quality to the removal of that screen. Or there's other real kind of simple scenarios. If you are shooting some green trees over a green screen, I'd rather you probably shot that over a blue screen instead. It's going to be a lot easier. Sometimes the actor or actress's hair color will make a big difference. Using a blue screen with blonde hair will give you a different result than using a green screen with blonde hair. So it really depends on the particular scenario, again, even some of your casting choices. But it's not nearly as big a deal as it used to be back in the past.
Wow. Well, you know, going back just a bit, I believe it was Speed 2 with Keanu Reeves where they put all the extras on the boat in the final scene in digitally. I mean, it was a post effect as opposed to having all of the extras on the boat or the ship itself. And at that time, there was big concern and big worry from actors and extras and, you know, that people are going to be replaced. Obviously, if you had, like in Lawrence Arabia, 10,000 people on horseback, they were all getting paid something, where now, if you only need a handful and can do it all magically, you know, through post, there are certainly different, you know, ramifications for different people and jobs being replaced. Any thoughts on that?
I guess that's a fair concern. From our end of the industry, 99% of the people that work on the shows with me are never on set. We never meet the actors. We don't deal with that so much. So we kind of like to joke sometimes that all the actors and everything there, they're really just props on set, no different than you know, a can of corn or anything like that, and we can move them around and reposition them and time warp their performances and make them work. I can appreciate it from the actor's point of view. That's a big deal. The actor is never going to go away.
Right.
You will have scenarios in films like Avatar where actors are being replaced, but that's $300 million. There's not too many films like that being made, and I think 99% of the actors will never be in that particular scenario.
Right.
There are moments, though, where we'll be making small little adjustments, and sometimes it's as simple as a tuft of hair that's sticking out funny that the hair and makeup department didn't quite catch, and we'll be asked just to, you know, give them a little tiny bit of a haircut. There'll be scenarios where we're asked to paint out a wrinkle, and is that changing somebody's performance or not? Then there'll be times that we'll reposition someone on frame. It's still their performance, and it's still the spirit of their performance. It's just getting augmented slightly, and I think most people would rather have that augmented slightly as opposed to getting that particular shot cut from the film because it doesn't work. As for completely replacing performances, there are moments there. Most of the time, there are safety concerns. You know, most people would rather have a stunt double do something, and we will replace the face with the actor's face in that particular shot. I think they're the corners, we're maybe rounding the corners off of an actor's performance, but we're certainly not replacing it.
Well spoken. And and technically it's not your responsibility. You're doing what you're doing, and you're doing it by, you know, being involved in a production. So if they use fewer people and ask for more people to be put in, I mean, that's that's your job. I mean,
yeah,
so.
Yeah. And I guess it's
like
a matter
you,
of perspective as well. It's we're just making a movie, and we're trying to make the best movie possible. And you know, I realize that. I think that's what gets interesting too. What happens on set, that window is so small in the grand scheme of what's involved in making a movie. And again, quite often, you know, there's only a few people that are involved in a film longer than us, and that's, you know, so your producers, your director. Sometimes we're on board before the editor's even involved, and you see the whole sort of progression of a film. You get to see it from its bare-bone inkling all the way to the final delivery, and a lot of things change. I'm even thinking of one of the shots in District 9 where I feel sorry for the actor in particular. There's a scene in the film where our main characters are busting into the MNU lab, and as they are fighting their way through this facility, there are two extras there that are supposed to be recoiling in fear. And the one woman's performance was great, and the other guy's performance was sissious, for lack of a better term, and we just painted them up. We got rid of them in that particular plate. And I know he was probably sitting there in the theater in South Africa all excited to see himself in this film and saw his scene, and he was basically, poof, he was gone. It happens, but it's part of making a better picture and a longer picture, and the time on set is such a small but key component of that compared to what really goes on from start to finish on a film.
Well, you know, I mean, all actors and many extras, you know, if they've been in the business any length of time, are used to finding themselves on the cutting room floor, as it used to be said. Now they just get painted out.
exactly.
Nipped out. So let me ask you about District 9. I mean, this is a $30 million movie that grossed over $200 million worldwide. So why do you think that was successful? Now, you know, ultimately, I mean, we've got about 20 minutes or so left, you know, and there's a host of other things I'm going to want to ask you about in films like 2012 and Avatar and different things. But for now, let's District 9. Why do you think that was so successful? How was it built to succeed?
Okay, so for District 9, and first to kind of clarify for roles, because I know roles are very important. So on District 9, I was a visual effects sequence supervisor. So again, with all these sort of titles, we had in-house Dan Kaufman was our visual effects supervisor, who dealt directly with Neil Blomkamp, the director of that film. Mm-hmm. In this particular scenario, we didn't have a production side visual effects supervisor. So it was really Neil, then Dan. And then internally here, we split the whole film in half. So I was responsible for half of the film, and another supervisor was responsible for the other half. Just really important to get the titles clear for everybody involved, because a lot of people put their time and energy into that show.
Sure.
That film was a success because we were involved from the very, very beginning. That one, the director of that film, Neil, had a visual effects background himself, so he understood the language of and the nuances of what we do. He knew what was difficult in advance. He knew what was going to be expensive, what was going to be a challenge. He also involved the main partners here at Image Engine and the people at Weta, that's Peter Jackson's company down in New Zealand, early on, so that they could consult, help him get as much of his budget on the screen as possible. There was a lot of sort of concern in the industry from other visual effects companies that, you know, Avatar cost $300 million to make, and here's this little company in Vancouver that's doing a feature film that looks pretty damn good on screen for $30 million, and that was going to change all of their bottom lines and their budgets. Usually, on most films, the visual effects budget can be sort of 10%, 20% of your expenses. I'm not sure what our final percentages were, but a lot more of it went into visual effects. They did that by, one, shooting on red cameras, so they didn't shoot on film. They kept their costs down by hiring actors, relatively no-name actors in the South African market for this film. The lead actor in District 9, this was his first acting performance. He was, I think, a university buddy of Neil's from back in the day. The work that we did, the characters, the way we designed them, there are some huge fundamental differences between the complexity of what we did and, for example, some of James Cameron's characters in that sort of film. They just kept a lot of things very, very simple. They didn't sort of inflate and sort of Hollywoodize the resources required so that the overwhelming majority of that money showed up in visual effects on screen as opposed to in other departments. So I think that's the key difference about why that film was successful.
So that is very interesting, very, very interesting. Why shouldn't other companies be rushing to try and duplicate what Image Engine...
I think they're going to try to. One of the other main reasons why the budget stayed low, and I think if you read interviews from Neil Blomkamp, at least at this particular stage moving forward, the larger the budget gets, the more chefs have a right to be in the kitchen on that particular film. So I think Neil has kind of gone on record saying he's trying to keep all of his films below $50 or $60 million. Now, I know that's a hell of a lot of money for most people, but for
right.
a visual effects film, that's relatively small. And by doing that, the director, especially a director that has visual vision as opposed to story vision, not that he doesn't, is able to be very clear and concise about what he or she wants and what the artistic direction is. When the films get larger, when the budgets get larger, when the stakes get larger, the studio involvement, the writer's involvement, everyone else's involvement, their priorities change a fair bit. And that's the big difference why if a film is shot with a smaller budget but with visual effects involved early, that this recipe can absolutely work again. But there's limitations. For example, we only had a few select characters. We had a lot of background characters. If you talk about character design, we didn't have flowing hair. If you think in Avatar, all of James Cameron's characters are running through. There's these big, long ponytails that are flopping about. In our world, that's a big deal. All of that has to be simulated. It has to run through mathematical programs to make sure that hair bounces and moves realistically. If you take a character and you wrap them up in baggy clothing with flaps hanging out, all of that has to simulate. It has to bounce around and move and act like real clothing. The other thing James Cameron did is he had skin. He had these characters. The properties of human skin are really, really subtle. You know, light comes in, bounces around underneath that skin, sort of scatters around. And that's why you look at some older films like Final Fantasy. That's got to be a good 10 years ago now. There's sort of a slightly dead, zombie-ish kind of quality to some of those characters. The amount of energy involved in trying to get a photorealistic character with all the muscles jiggling and all that movement, that's expensive and takes a lot of time. That's why James Cameron's film costs so much. Whereas for District 9, our character design was more like a walking lobster. You had these sort of shell-type pieces that moved and slid back and forth. There were only a few parts on the face that actually had skin-like qualities to it. And as a result, it was a lot less technically complicated to put that together. We could turn shots around much more quickly and keep the budgets down.
Wow. Anecdotally, about 20 years ago, the president of Foundation Imaging came to me actually as a student, and I've known him now ever since. His name is Ron Thornton, and he's it was a Heinlein movie, a Heinlein book. I want to say Battlestar. It's not. I can't think of what it was. Anyway, they did the TV series for this, and they came to me. He came to me because he wanted to learn what I do at the time. I have nothing to do with animation or visual effects, you know, but as a student of people, you know, and as a gift to me, he gave me, you know, at that time, the series on videotape. So, but he said that, you know, back then, that the biggest problem they had in doing animation and special effects was lighting in the mouth of the characters.
Yeah.
Because the way the light reflected off the teeth, they would have all these characters with just incredibly bright teeth, you know, and it didn't match the world. And what he was there for was learning, you know, kind of like what was the musculature that was involved in breathing shifts so that when you animated, you know, a body on the screen, that it paralleled what the actual human did as opposed to, you know, them just trying to, you know, draw it out, you know. So he wanted to learn to observe things more accurately so that he could animate better. And you know, I just mentioned that as an anecdote in terms of, and look at where we have come in all of these years, you know.
Exactly. Well, if you look at the human face, we look at the human face every morning, and we are aware of every small little nuance. And as moviegoers, our eye is becoming more and more educated, and we can just tell when something's not right. There's an expression in our industry, and it's called the uncanny valley. And the uncanny valley is, I think this started on the Shrek films, I believe. I could be mistaken on this, but Princess Fiona, a lot of the characters in Shrek are stylized, but Princess Fiona, they're originally pushing towards something that was more human. And the uncanny valley is that stage where, as you're developing and working on a character, trying to make it look more and more human and more photorealistic, as it gets to 90, 91, 92, 93% of the way there, there's a creepy place. And the creepy place is that last little percentage between 100% photorealistic and photorealistic.
Uh-huh.
And in that sort of phase, yeah, the character can look scary, creepy, ugly. It doesn't quite work because we are so familiar with the nuances of the human being. So they actually, in that film, dialed back on the photorealism, made her a little bit more stylized because she wasn't responding well. People weren't responding well to her look. And the amount of energy involved in trying to get something to be 100% photorealistic, even if you think about the Avatar characters, you know, they are still stylized, and there's you know, they aren't human. They're very human-like in their properties, but painting them blue and changing the color of their eyes and putting sparkles all over their body takes them a little bit away from that place and from that uncanny valley.
Wow. We've got literally about 12 minutes left, John. And I got a lot more to talk to you about, so I'm going to tell the listeners now that you will be coming back, and of course we'll have to schedule, you know, let them know when that date is going to be, and have them stay tuned so that they know when to listen in for the continuation of this. I wanted to ask you something, and then I want to ask you a question from the chat room. My dad, God love him, before he died, used to tell me that he couldn't watch TV because things happened too quickly, you know, in his later or his advanced years, and that you know, it was hard for him to follow the story. And I thought, well, you know, I don't know. Now, Peter Tolan, who's the series creator of the FX series Rescue Me, and he's done many, many movies, Analyze This and other things, said that there's a term called, I think it's called the NYPD correction. In other words, when NYPD Blue came out, you know, the camera was all over the place. And forgive me if I'm misquoting and if I'm inaccurate as to whose correction it was, but the camera moves all over the place, and then all of a sudden it locks in, and then in the next scene it's moving all over and it locks in, and you know, it's like they correct their shot in the middle of the shot, and it's drawn more attention to the camera probably today than ever before. Where I grew up in filmmaking, the rule of thumb was you're not supposed to know that the camera's moving. You're just supposed to be in awe of the whole cinematic effect and the beauty of the thing, but not kind of have that fourth wall broken for yourself where you go, wow, that's a good shot, until long after the film. You know, I mean, once you're analyzing the film, it's okay, but during the film, you're supposed to be in the story and not notice the... The equivalent would be if you dropped your boom mic in, I guess, you know, just to say, yes, we're doing sound here now. It's like, okay, now we're adjusting. Anyway, my question stems from, I have a similar difficulty, and I don't know if it's me or if it's the current state of some of the visual effects. I go see Transformers or Spider-Man 3 or whatever, and the you know, this guy's swinging on his Spidey web stuff, and I can barely see him. I can barely track him. And animators or Transformers happen so quickly in so many of the cases that I'm going, wow, and the next thing I know, they're off and doing something. Now, either it's me in my advanced age or my eyes just aren't tracking the way it used to, or things are going by really, really fast. And is there a reason for why it's so fast or why this choice is made?
I think that's usually going to be, I guess part of it is sort of target markets. You can make the argument that it's the MTV generation, and they're, those young kids, they're used to things moving so quick and quick cuts and sort of fast-paced, and you know, people take a look at that and assume that that is energy and pacing in a film. I think those same sort of things exist, whether it's visual effects or not. There are these, you know, quick-moving moments. Now, granted, from a technical point of view, we can hide a lot of things when the camera's moving very, very quickly. So sometimes that's to our benefit, but that's no excuse for why things should be moving so fast. Ultimately, every single shot in the film is supposed to create some sort of an emotional reaction, and maybe that's the reaction that the director's looking for in that particular stage, is a sense of nausea. It's a tool, and I do think that sometimes it is overused. You know, one of the things we're going to talk about is 2012. 2012 is a film
yeah.
where visual effects is really almost the character. And, you know, I don't mean to take away from Mr. Cusack's performance in that one, but it's, yeah, the visual effects were really the lead character in that particular film, and everything smashing and breaking and being part of that. It's a tool, and it's storytelling, and if you look at the top 10 grossing films of all time, every single one of those is can be classified as a visual effects heavy film. The audiences seem to be responding to it, yeah, I don't know if I actually have an answer for whether why it's happening or not, and why there's so much camera movement there. But audiences seem to respond, be voting with their feet and their dollars, and until that changes, they'll continue to whip the camera around.
Well, that's a perfect answer, I guess it should be fairly obvious too. I mean, unless it's not bringing in the dollars, you know, they're going to keep doing it. And it also goes to that we do see differently. I mean, each of us sits in the movie theater and pays attention to different things. If I sit there with my young son, you know, he because of the way he's growing up, he'll see it differently than I see it, you know, at my age. So you know, and he loves the movie, so you know, I can't fault that, you know, but it did seem for me it's hard to follow. Not hard to follow the story in the way it used to be, I think, that my dad described, but just hard to follow all the stuff that's occurring on the screen in a given moment. To me, it does tend to seem blurry as opposed to concise. I do agree with you, though. You know, I mean, we had Rocky Lang, whose father, Jennings Lang, produced Earthquake, and I remember when Earthquake opened and Towering Inferno and Big Poseidon Adventure back in the day. I mean, we love big stories like 2012. We like to see things blow up and destroyed or waves come over. You know, I mean, I agree. I mean, I definitely think that there's, you know, a place for visual effects. And I don't even have a problem when it's sometimes the star of the film. I would like to think that if it is the star of the film, it's got a great story behind it so that I'm while I'm being bedazzled by the special effects, I'm also engaged in the story. You made an excellent point there. When we come back another time, we'll have to talk more about like Avatar and the difference between Avatar and, say, District 9 or Avatar and the Twilight series, independent film versus studio pictures and that kind of stuff. But I want to ask you about stereoscopic film and the rise of stereoscopic film. And there's actually a question in the chat room. It says, does John see the 3D wave continuing and building, or is it a little bump in the movie making and watching technology?
That's a tough call on that one. I think we might be in a small little window there where there's a level of success right now. Avatar is obviously breaking all sorts of records with their 3D film. Alice in Wonderland is going gangbusters right now. I haven't seen it myself yet. I know some people have some issues with the story on it, but it's certainly making money. And I think people have to recall, at least on the big studio side of things, if it's making money, and people are paying the extra $5, $6, $7 to see a 3D film, then studios will continue to make it. Whether it's good film or, you know, I certainly don't expect to ever see Leaving Las Vegas as a 3D film remake by any means. But for certain types of stories and certain types of event films, 3D can be great for that. Same time, though, I was reading an online article about that, and they talked about when animated films first came out, and when Pixar first came out, there was, I think it was Toy Story was a huge success. Shortly thereafter, a whole bunch of other companies rushed out to do the same sort of thing, and a lot of them were not successes. I think we'll probably see a couple of 3D films flop in the short term while people rush to try and get in on this particular wave. And just like any other advancement in technology, there'll be a period of time where people figure out how to use the tool better. I think story will still be paramount. So I think they'll be around. I just don't know if there'll be the absolute sort of proliferation and wave to do this. There's also different things going on in the industry right now. There are two ways of shooting a stereoscopic film. One is shooting it stereoscopic on set with the cameras, the James Cameron approach. The other technology that's being evolved right now is to shoot traditionally and turn it into a 3D film later. I think G-Force, that sort of kids comedy with the gerbils and the hamsters, was an example of a film where it was shot traditionally. It's pretty hard to get these big, massive 3D cameras down to ground level to shoot a gerbil. So it was all filmed traditionally. And there are people in departments that go about and break that film apart and create all of the planes and the depth and recreate that as a 3D film. When you get into the nuances of the technology, there's certain things that, just like there is an art to editing a film, there is also an art in cutting from one 3D shot to the next, and suddenly editors need to start worrying about depth as well, where the focus is in a particular shot. And there's a great seminar from DreamWorks talking about how they, in their 3D films, which you have 100% control over the cameras, the science and the art of creating 3D stereoscopic cuts and making sure that that you visually don't jump through the scene from the end of one shot into the next. So I think just like that, it's technology. It will take some time to evolve, and people will make some mistakes. There'll be some films that turned into 3D that shouldn't have been, and there'll be some backlash to that, and it will find its groove in due time.
An excellent answer. And we've got about 2 minutes remaining, and I want to give you the last word. But you know, I noticed that in history there have been certain price bump changes. The first that I recall was movies went from, I think, $3 to $4 with Star Wars. That was about 1976 or 77, whenever that came out, or 78, well, I don't remember the year exactly. And they bumped again up to $5 when Apocalypse Now came out. And of course, when Apocalypse Now came out, they also ended the notion of credits. We went to the Pacific Cinerama Dome in Hollywood, and we got, you know, a playbill card, a movie card with the credits. There were none on the screen at the time. You know, I mean, so there's always significant changes. Now Avatar comes out, people pay another, you know, $4 or $5 to see it in 3D. I mean, you know, but that also goes to, you know, that these movies cost a lot of money to make. Each one of them, you know, changed our movie going habits in many ways. I know nothing, you know, of the 3D world in that regard, so I can't comment other than say it would probably be smart of me to agree. and so I agree. With the remaining minute and a half or so, John, is there just anything? We will come back. We will let the listeners know when you're going to be back, and I'm excited to have you back. This has been a fascinating discussion, and there's lots of state of the what's going on in the service work right now in visual effects and the whole changes in the film industry and television. I mean, we've got a lot that we can talk, and I just want to thank you for your participation now, but I do want to give you this like last minute and a half. If there's anything you want to say to anybody out there regarding you know, their career choice or advice that you could give them or anything, please do.
Well, if anybody's interested in getting into this business, you know, I'm happy to answer questions with respect to that. It's not an easy one, but it is incredibly artistically liberating in that sort of side of things. There are some long hours. There is a paying your dues phase, which is probably no different than any other industry. You know, I'm looking from my office here down to the crew on the floor. There are some long, tired faces, and this isn't just a month or two on set. This is 6, 7, 8, 9 months of time. Lots of fun, lots of chance for creativity, lots of chances to be a filmmaker on an individual shot-by-shot basis that you may not get in other aspects of this industry, but it is an industry that's still maturing, and there's some bumpy rides still ahead as that sorts itself out.
Oh, very aptly put. And when we come back, we'll talk more about Eclipse as much as we can. I know, like I said, you know, we pointed out that it's proprietary at this point. You know, Avatar, District 9, 2012, you know, state of this industry and visual effects and visual effects supervision. Mr. John Colley, you have been a fascinating guest. Thank you so much for your participation today. I know you have to get to this crew of about 80 people and have your work day cut out for you, so I'm going to let you do that, and I wish you well, sir. We'll talk real
Thanks,
soon
sir.
About letting everything, you know, catching up on this, but thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity.
All right. Enjoy your day. And that was Mr. John Cowley, visual effects supervisor, and he wears other hats as well, depending on what the movie is, but a visual effects supervisor, and what an interesting, fascinating conversation. that is, and an area that I know little about, but am learning just like many of the rest of you, I suppose. And the comments in the chat room are very interesting. Thanks for, you know, the answering the questions, things like that. So we're all very pleased. We have got many more exciting guests coming up in the near future at RexSykes.com. That's Rex Sykes Movie Beat. So please stay tuned, and please keep sharing this website and these interviews with all of your friends and your contacts. If you're going to go to the Wisconsin Film to the 18th, I'm going to be there on the 16th and probably the 17th. I'll see you there. I'll meet you there. You can become a member of the Rex Sykes Movie Beat Facebook group by clicking on the group link at my profile page on Facebook. There's also Rex Sykes Movie Beat Friends. That's the fan page. Join that, please. Spread the word. And if you're a Wisconsin resident and you're a Wisconsin filmmaker, join Wisconsin Film Jobs. Keep Wisconsin film friendly. It is my cause. It's on my profile page. It's on the left side. Just look for it, click on it, and join the cause, because we're trying to keep building our infrastructure and our industry here in the state of Wisconsin. All right, everybody, have a fabulous day. Again, thanks, Mr. John Cowley. Make your movies. Complete your projects. Sarah Neen Bruce, producer-director, is coming up next. Until we meet the next time, that's a wrap.